Racine, 61 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Bird is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one, we look at the life and career and legacy of one of the great legends of track and field coaching. In part two, we'll be hearing a report on some technological breakthroughs in the field of police work. Stay with us. We are going to be exploring the world of running, and I must say right at the outset, I am not a runner, and I have to say I've also been kind of bewildered by the whole notion of people being coached to run. Isn't running just the simplest of endeavors, albeit maybe something that we're not all good at, but what could be more basic than running? In fact, running is a bit of a mystery, and especially when one runs long distances at an elite level. And I have learned so much from a fascinating new book called Running to the Edge, A Band of Misfits and the Guru Who Unlocked the Secrets of Speed. The guru mentioned in the book's subtitle is one Bob Larson, who became really a legendary coach in track and field, and especially made his name for himself back in the early 1970s by working with a really intriguing a band of a kind of ragtag distance runners who became a real powerhouse in the sport. And this was at a time when running was not the commonplace hobby that it is nowadays. And so Bob Larson really broke new ground and then, in a sense, returned to some of that work very late in his career and with tremendous success once again. And this story is told so thoroughly in a meticulously prepared book written by Matthew Futterman, who is deputy sports editor for the New York Times, a previous writer for the Wall Street Journal, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he is actually part of a team that won the Pulitzer Prize for breaking news back in 2005, and a bit of a runner himself, and responsible for this really marvelous book. Again, it's titled Running to the Edge, A Band of Misfits and the Guru Who Unlocked the Secrets of Speed, published by Doubleday. Matthew Futterman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Right off the bat, explain to our listeners your own status as a runner and the place that running has had in your life.
Well, I mean, from a pure sort of numbers perspective, I'm definitely a devoted, sort of addicted long-distance runner. I just ran my 23rd marathon, so I think there's some people who would say I've got a little bit of a problem there. I've really been running almost as long as I can remember. I don't really remember myself before I was a runner. I think I started, you know, when I was about 10 years old, I ran a 5-mile race, and that was sort of the birth of it. But I can remember being, you know, roughly that age and being so admiring of the people who were running the New York Marathon, which was really in its infancy back then in the late 70s. And I always wanted to do that. And so I guess I was kind of a runner before I was even running all that much. And I ran cross country in high school, and, you know, I was never very good. I wasn't all that fast. But I love the activity, and I've sort of been running, you know, nearly every day since I was a teenager, so, you know, roughly 35 years or so.
One of the really intriguing things about the book, which is mostly about this legendary coach, Bob Larson, and some of his best runners with which he worked over the years, but interspersed in the book are these short chapters that are really your own story as a runner. And I really like that. I think it's a very, very nice addition to the book. And I want to ask you specifically about something you write from one of these short little chapters, which is headlined Fayetteville, Arkansas, 1992. You write, "When I first moved here from New York to a land that feels far more foreign than the handful of foreign countries I have been to, I run because it's the only time during the day when I feel like myself. Every other waking minute, I am an alien in what is for me a very strange land." Can you just say a quick word about how, at least at this point in your life and probably other points in your life, running served this sort of purpose for you?
Well, I can say that back in 1991, when I moved to Arkansas, the world was a lot bigger place. Back then, the internet didn't exist for regular folks, and there wasn't email. You were really out of contact with. I grew up in New York, and so I was very much sort of a coastal person. It was very sort of out of contact with, you know, what I would say is like urbanity. And, you know, if you wanted a copy of the New York Times, you had to line up at the library at about 2:30 in the afternoon. On Sundays, about 50 copies would get flown in to the local drugstore. And so it was a faraway place back then. And, you know, and I used to, at that point, now I'm a morning runner, but at that point I was sort of an afternoon runner, late afternoon. And I would sort of go through my day, and people didn't talk like I did. They didn't sound like I did. They ate different foods than I did. I didn't know what pork rinds were. I didn't know what chicken fried steak was. And then I would sort of, you know, go for my run, and I would start to feel comfortable with myself again. And, you know, that was a great year in my life, in part because I did one of the things that is sort of actually the tenet of the Bob Larson training regimen, which is to make yourself comfortable with being uncomfortable. And that's really sort of where the title comes from, is sort of pushing yourself to the edge. That's why I call the book Running to the Edge, because I think it's so important both in running and in life to push yourself and challenge yourself and do the things that you're afraid of. Whether it's running really fast for 5 or 6 or 8 or 11 miles, or moving to a strange place where you don't know anybody for a while and seeing how that feels. So that's sort of where running fits in, both as a exercise activity and a kind of approach to life for me.
When we see the title of your book and we see the word guru, and we understand that this is a story that, at least at the outset, unfolds in California in the early 1970s, we maybe jump to some conclusions about where that guru, namely track legend Bob Larson, came from. In fact, he was a Minnesota farm boy. And I wonder if you could just say a word about, in a sense, that disconnect between where his life started, the very ordinary beginning of his life, and where he ultimately ended up.
Well, he started out, right, you said, on a farm in northern Minnesota, no plumbing, no electricity. And, you know, as he talked about it to me, he told me what his life was like. You know, it was an incredible, you know, how hard the work was that they had to do every day, whether it was plowing fields with a team of horses or milking cows or, you know, just even canning vegetables so they could make it through the winter, or storing meat in a freezer several miles south of them, because they didn't have a freezer on their own farm, so they had to raise cattle and store whatever meat they had down there. And so when they wanted to eat meat, they'd have to go get their supply of meat for the week. So he was there for the first 11 years of his life until his father fell out of the haymow and really had a pretty serious injury to his back, serious enough that he wasn't going to be a farm worker and he wasn't going to be able to run a farm anymore. And they moved to San Diego, and that's really where Bob discovered competitive running. He'd been running on the farm sort of as a means of transportation, a way to get from point A to point B. Friends were a couple miles away, school was a couple miles away, and he would often find himself running there. And so that was his life, and it morphed when he moved to the city. He had all this strength, and he knew how to work hard, and he also happened to be born pretty darn fast. And that was where, actually, he felt comfortable, too. He felt most comfortable, too, because he was sort of, you know, a fish out of water moving from northern Minnesota to what felt like a big city to him. And, you know, like you mentioned before, when I moved to Arkansas, sort of feeling comfortable with himself at those moments when he was running, that was almost when he felt sort of as, like, the best version of himself.
Right. And he finds himself prompted to ask the question, why do we run? And what should our state of being be when we're running? And of course, it's an intriguing question, and I suppose the answer is a little bit different for every single person. And this is part of the key of how he was able to work with talented runners at such a high level. Explain kind of the state of running in the early 1970s compared to what it is now, and to what extent anybody ran recreationally outside of their own high school track team, for instance.
Well, it was a very niche activity, and niche is probably an overstatement for what it was. You just would not see people running recreationally back then. There was basically, you know, there was only one marathon that anyone knew about, which was the Boston Marathon. And New York had started in 1970, but it didn't, you know, it didn't really catch on until it became a five-borough race in 1976. And, you know, there was nothing more rebellious that you could do than sort of, I mean, there were more things that you could do to be rebellious, but in terms of like a recreational activity, you know, going for a 20-mile run on a Saturday morning in the early 1970s was a bit like, you know, going to climb Everest or something like that. You know, people really thought those people were really sort of on the edges of society. And, you know, I will say that even though this has become a very mainstream activity, you know, you go out in any park any morning, you're going to see a lot of people running. It's just sort of a part of so many people's lives and their routine. I still think there is a spirit of rebellion at the roots of it, especially as you climb higher in the distances. I know a great appeal of the activity for me is the idea that I feel like I'm doing something that's, you know, a little bit crazy and that other people think is a little bit crazy. And that's okay. That's sort of a real kind of release for me. And, you know, when I was approaching writing a book, I long wanted to write a book about running, but I was looking for the right story that could get at those emotions and that spirit. and I think I found them in, as we put in the subtitle, the team of misfits known as the Hummel Toads, who were Bob Larson's lab rats in the 60s and 70s, and when he was learning about, you know, how to make people run very far, very fast. Hmm.
We're speaking with Matthew Futterman about his book, Running on the Edge, A Band of Misfits and the Guru Who Unlocked the Secrets of Speed. So explain the way in which these young athletes that you call a band of misfits were a band of misfits. I mean, in a sense, what an unlikely group they were to score some of the great successes that they ultimately did.
Well, if you talk about a guy named Ed Mendoza, Ed is a Mexican American. Comes from a Mexican immigrant family, and is living in San Diego. And he's tiny. He's even when as an adult he only grew to be about 5'5". But he, as a child, was tiny, and he thought his body was basically worthless. He didn't really know, and he didn't know anything. He didn't know what competitive track and field was. Until he was in a high school gym class, and the gym teacher made him run and said, by the way, you're one of the fastest kids in the school, and you could probably be one of the fastest kids in the county. And running became the vehicle through which he understood that his body had this purpose. And it got injured a lot. He was very prone to stress fractures in his shins. So in some ways he was born with, and the engine of a Jaguar and, the machinery of a VW Bug or something like that. But, he came to run. That's how he came to running. A guy named Tom Lux, who was on this team, he was basically a juvenile delinquent until his brother made him run and Bob Larson told him he could be special. And turns out he was. And Kirk Pfeffer had a hard time relating to other kids and talking to people. But, as they interviewed him, he talked about being 8 years old and waking up early in the morning in San Diego and going for these runs around the block so he could smell, the juniper and the eucalyptus and all the other stuff that's always blooming in San Diego and the sense of peace it brought him. These were not necessarily alpha males. These were guys who were sort of had this gift, and Larson was able to recognize it and cultivate it and turn them into a team that bonded together and really was able to achieve incredible success.
Right. Well, and ultimately, success even on a nationwide scale and against very elite sort of opponents that most outside observers would assume they had no chance of beating. Just explain kind of the landscape in which they scored some very, very impressive success.
Well, when you talk about the national success, we're talking about the 1976 National Cross Country Championships.
Right.
Which at the time are really it's really sort of the biggest distance race in the country outside of the Boston Marathon, in terms of people, and maybe the Olympic Trials Marathon, in terms of runners really sort of circling it on their calendar and running with their teams and trying to make names for themselves. And Bob Larson always wanted to put a group of local San Diego runners that were running the way, following his regimen and following his ideas and philosophies. He thought, he thought his guys were pretty good. And the problem was people hadn't really heard of him. They hadn't done anything internationally yet, and they just weren't given much of a chance. The power, the theory was that, places like, to the extent that there was running in the consciousness, it was happening in places like Boulder, Colorado, Eugene, Oregon. New York Athletic Club had some runners, obviously a much larger population pool to draw from. And yet there was this team from San Diego. And, what made them different is that they trained the right way. And they trained the way almost every elite runner trains today. And that was what Bob Larson figured out before anybody else did. He figured out essentially how the Kenyans and Ethiopians train before the Ethiopians and the Kenyans figured out how they train and how they became the dominant long-distance running countries in the world. And it really goes back to three principles. It goes back to becoming comfortable with being uncomfortable, you know, pushing yourself to that threshold, going on these long, hard runs, building up your volume, and mixing in some speed work as well. It comes from understanding that you train as a group, that even though this is an individual sport and kind of a solitary activity, the power of the group is far stronger than the power of the individual. If you're slacking off, it's great to have teammates there to make sure you don't slack off. And then finally, but just having a certain belief, a belief that it does not matter where you're born or how you're born, that does not create your destiny. That if you train right and work hard and do the right things, you can be better tomorrow than you were yesterday, and you can eventually compete with the best runners in the country and the world.
Right, and it doesn't matter if your team has fancy matching uniforms and some kind of a nice endorsement deal. That does not matter in terms of how you will do on the track. Eventually, of course, Bob Larson, because he scores such great success, moves up into the collegiate ranks and becomes a great legend, I think, at UCLA, right?
Yeah.
And moves into kind of the shorter distances. That's just kind of where the action is, and gives a little less focus to what always remains his first love, which is distance running. And during this time, America's greatness at distance running goes into a precipitous decline. And your book explains that a lot of that perhaps has to do with one Alberto Salazar, who might be a familiar name to some of our listeners, who was a brilliant comet for a very short period of time, and then his career just crashed. And in a sense, a lot of other runners sort of crashed inadvertently in the wake of that. Explain briefly that connection between the fortunes of Alberto Salazar and then America's presence in long-distance running.
Yeah, there's no question Salazar was the best marathoner in the world for a while. Won everything, won New York, won Boston, and, you know, his crowning achievement was supposed to be the 84 Olympics. But beginning in 1983, he started to have some nagging injuries, and he just really lost his speed. At the Olympics, I think he ended up running about a 2:15, and, you know, much slower than he had run in New York previously and in Boston. And he never really recovered. And people took a false lesson. Took the false lesson from that, because no one trained harder than Alberto. Alberto was an absolute madman when it came to training, running with 105 fever and, you know, all sorts of things, and nearly dying in the Falmouth road race on a humid day. So Alberto was really kind of a seminal figure in American running. But then when he crashed, the idea that people took from that was, well, he just ran too hard and he ran himself into a wall. And, you know, we all are born with a certain number of steps and a certain number of beats, high stress beats of the heart. And once you use those up, they're done. And so what people did is they kind of forgot the lessons that Bob Larson had been preaching in the 1970s about running hard, about doing all those things we talked about previously, about training with a group and making sure so you can make sure other people push yourselves and doing the volume, both volume and speed at the same time. And it didn't work. You know, the thing about running is there are no shortcuts. If you want to learn how to run far fast, you better practice running far fast. For lay runners like me, you know, if you want to finish a marathon, you better run, 20, 22, 24 miles before marathon day. It's all about the preparation and it's all about the work. And, you know, by the time the 2000 Olympics rolled around, we could only qualify one person for the men's marathon. And that was when Bob left UCLA and said, you know what, I want to fix this thing. We're a huge country. We can be better than this. We just honestly have to do what not only the Kenyans and Ethiopians are doing now in the Rift Valley in Africa, but what I was doing with my Homo toads back in the 1970s, and that's what they did. They created the Mammoth Track Club, which was a small running group, first of its kind, really, in the U.S., and there are 6 marathon medals given out at the Olympics, and that little group in Mammoth Lakes, California, ended up with 2 of them in 2004, one for Meb Keflezighi and one for Dina Castor.
Mm. Both of their stories are so intriguing, and of course we can read about both of them in your book. Explain just a little bit of the science behind this notion of doing training at high altitudes, or an interesting variation on that, which is the possibility of living at high altitudes but training at lower altitudes. But this whole idea of altitude mattering a lot for a distance runner.
Well, your body adjusts to altitude where there's less oxygen by creating more blood cells and more red blood cells, because the red blood cells are in charge of carrying the oxygen to the rest of your body, to the muscles. So it adjusts in that way. And so if you eat just by sleeping at high altitude at 8,000 feet, you'll generate more red blood cells, and that will be greatly beneficial to you. Now, if you run and you put your body under a certain amount of strain, that's even better. Your body will create even more red blood cells to try and compensate for the hard work. However, that puts a lot of strain on your body. So what a lot of times they did was they lived in Mammoth Lakes, which is about 8,000 feet. But sometimes when they would train, they would go down to 4,000 or 5,000 feet. So they're still running at altitude and working harder than they would at sea level because there's less oxygen there to breathe. It's just much harder. But they weren't overstraining themselves by doing the really hard workouts at 8,000 feet, 9,000 feet, which doesn't mean that sometimes they didn't run up to 9,000 feet. They did. Those are some tough days, but it's called live high, train low, and it apparently creates a nice balance. I've never done it. I would love to do it sometime. I'd love to see if I could get a little faster in my marathons.
So, what was it like for you to connect with some of these runners that Bob Larson first worked with? I mean, most with names that none of us would recognize. And how surprised were they that anybody was interested in them and their part of Bob Larson's story?
They were pretty surprised that they could. I mean, they felt they had done something pretty special. They didn't really think the world was going to sort of pay to. They thought it was sort of a little accident of history, and that it would just be a nice story, and they would go from there. But having said that, when I reached out to them, they were the whole key to the book. So it was a matter of figuring out whether they, as characters, they could carry the story in the way, as a writer, I felt they needed to. And, in calling them and reaching out to them, each one had really a better story than the next one. So that was just a real relief once I reached out to them and heard that. You know, like I told you the story of Ed Mendoza before and Tom Lux. And, them talking about their teammate Terry Cotton, who would just run like a madman. And the term I came up with, he would run as though he only had one speed, and he would run as though he was being chased by a man with an axe. That was sort of the way he would get after it. And people really talk about him in sort of this legendary way because he was just so darn fast and just so talented.
And, of course, you also got to connect with Meb Keflezighi, who won the silver medal at the Athens Olympics in the marathon. And you describe him as an incredibly emotionally generous person. And most of these men with whom you spoke, it sounds like they really opened up to you in an incredible way.
Yeah, certainly. I've been lucky enough to get to know Meb over the years. And, the wonderful thing about running is, and I, this is really unique to so many sports, unique to running as compared with so many other sports, is that the elite athletes in running, you know, they love to talk about running with lay runners. I could never talk about my Little League baseball experiences with, Mike Trout or anyone like that. But Meb has no problem talking about my training with me and doing it in sort of a peer-to-peer way. As Abdi Abdurrahman once said to me, you know, we all experience the pain of a marathon. We just experience it at different times. And it's a neat thing about the culture that running really engenders, and it's one of the reasons I love the sport so much.
Well, you certainly help us all, especially those of us who have no connection whatsoever with this sport or with this world, understand it so much better. And beyond, of course, understanding this brilliant man named Bob Larson and all that he did to transform the sport. The book, again, is Running to the Edge, A Band of Misfits and the Guru Who Unlocked the Secrets of Speed, published by Doubleday, the author, Matthew Futterman. Matthew Futterman, congratulations on a really great book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure to be here.
I want to add that Matthew Futterman does a marvelous job of describing the science behind long-distance running and some of the intricacies and subtle touches of Bob Larson's training procedures. He also does a great job of describing the drama that was part of some of the most important races of Bob Larson's coaching career. For instance, he talks about the marathon race in the 2004 Olympic Games in Athens, and makes an observation that I had never stopped to consider about the Olympic marathon. He writes, "An Olympic marathon is unique in the sport of long-distance running. In addition to the weight and history of the race, the competition brings a unique challenge. In all the other major marathons, runners return to the same streets each year. They become familiar with the nuances of each course. In New York, they know about the deceptive hills and those five bridges, and that the real race doesn't begin until Central Park at the 24th mile. They know that Boston is flat and downhill for the better part of 16 miles, mostly uphill for five, then down again to the finish. They know about the damp chill of London, the almost eerie flatness of Chicago, the fast straight boulevards in Berlin. They come to them again and again and run them in their mind as they find similar terrain in training. In every Summer Games, the event on the Olympic marathon course is the first and likely the last time the race will take place on that exact route. An Olympic marathon course is once in a lifetime. There is no learning curve, no chance to acclimate yourself to its unique falls and rises, its prevailing weather, the sounds of its crowds, and the feeling of the pavement beneath your feet, the special approach to the Olympic Stadium." I want to finish by reading an excerpt from a chapter called Fall and Rise. "Distance races and running itself rarely proceed according to plan. Just when the race appears to be won, when it seems like you have unlocked the secret truths, the unexpected happens. Intense heat or cold or miserable rain on the start line, tweaked ligaments, turned ankles, stress fractures, busted hips. In this way, running far, and trying to do it as quickly as possible may be most similar to life. Optimism may abound, but unexpected danger that rises with the most unsympathetic callousness is always lurking, always looking to knock back anyone who wants to tempt fate and believe too strongly that his running life is heading upward, ever upward. Turn a corner and there is a car that has drifted to the wrong side of the road. Visit a doctor for dizziness or headaches, and he begins to speak about a grave illness. These aren't inevitabilities, but they are possibilities, rising to whack us whether we expect it or not. We can think we are prepared to deal with them, but we can't be, just like we can't ever truly be prepared for the torn ACL, the incessant stabbing pain of high hamstring tendonitis, This is why running, and life too, the most important part of it anyway, always has to be about what we do next. In its most basic form, the running motion is a controlled forward burst that ends with a fall. Each step is a leap. Gravity brings us back to Earth, where our feet catch us and push us back up and forward again. Rise and fall, and rise again. Do this roughly 40,000 times, and you will cross the finish line of a marathon. Success comes not by dwelling on the step that has just happened, or the subpar training session, or even the missed workout, or the disappointing race, or the extra miles that led to the busted knee, or the nagging tightness in the oblique muscle that will not relent. Those miles, those training sessions, they are gone. Over. It can all begin again in some form if we want it to, though we have to figure out how to make it so. A new day, a new run, a new opportunity. There will be terrible races and glorious ones, miserable, injury-riddled years, and years of seeming invincibility. After the thrilling ascendance of youth, life and running become a series of episodes of ups and downs, falls and rises. Really, all that matters is what we do next. What's that you say? The past is never dead. It's not even past. Good writer, that William Faulkner. Probably not much of a runner. An excerpt from Running to the Edge, A Band of Misfits and the Guru Who Unlocked the Secrets of Speed, published by Doubleday, the author Matthew Futterman. I'm Gregory Berg. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. And for the next few minutes, we're going to be talking about some interesting innovations in the field of crime prevention and in the work of police across the country. We're going to be talking about an initiative called SPI, Strategies for Policing Innovation, and about some study that has been done in this by the nonprofit research organization CNA. Chip Coldren is the Managing Director of Justice Programs in CNA's Safety and Security Division, and he has been kind of leading the effort in exploring just what has been going on with this matter of SPI in various policing districts across the country. Mr. Coldren, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So tell us, first of all, what initiated this matter of strategies for policing innovation? What sort of issues were hoped to be addressed by starting this initiative?
Yes, so this initiative started about 10 years ago. And back then, that was around 2009, which is just after the 2008 recession. And what we were observing is that in a number of communities across the country, policing services were being reduced. Budgets were being reduced, and the police force itself was getting smaller. At the same time, the work of policing was getting more complex, and public expectations of what the police would do were not diminishing. And so the federal government realized that the police needed to focus on being more efficient and more effective, and learning how to do more with less. And so that was the genesis of the policing innovation work. They also felt at the time that the strategies being put in place to reduce crime and violence in this country were getting rather stale. They were seeing the same types of proposals and the same types of suppression-oriented approaches, you know, being offered up again and again and again, and they truly desired to inject some innovation in the way the you know, police approach their public safety work.
One of the hallmarks, apparently, is a new recognition of the significance of research, that research needs to go hand-in-hand with the work that police departments do and needs to be at the heart of many of the decisions they make about how they're going to do what they do. Tell us more about the kind of research that we are talking about, or the way in which research could be a valuable tool for a given police district.
Right. So, hand-in-hand with innovation is the need to adapt and the need to use science and information to learn better how to adapt to the dynamic nature of crime and the social order. So what research does is it helps police agencies, you know, working with a researcher, helps police agencies to identify and analyze the data that they need to look at in order to find new ways of doing things and be more effective. But maybe more importantly, once they try something new, they need to test and see if what they did that was new actually made a difference in the community. And the best way to do that is to conduct a research analysis that has a comparative aspect to it. So you have to compare your community to another community. You just can't look at the before and after of an intervention. You have to look at a place where this intervention was not tried and see if the results are different in the places that it was tried. So, and the other interesting thing about research and this use of data is it actually makes the police more transparent. So it has a wonderful public education function in that people now learn more and see more, not only what police are doing, but they learn how they're doing it and why they're doing it and whether it's actually having an impact on public safety. And we can say with confidence that in the 57 communities that have undertaken SPI projects over the past 10 years, in most of them, the public safety impacts have been positive and very significant.
I think one of the interesting things I noticed in the report that is about to be released to the public about what your study uncovered is that in some cases, what we're talking about is the use of maybe research in an innovative way, but often then what ends up being kind of implemented is not any sort of groundbreaking technological breakthrough. In many cases, it's utilizing tools that have been with us for a long time. I'm thinking of the story of Philadelphia and of how they identified certain hotspots, and then to those hotspots where crime was a big issue, trying to deploy foot patrols in more concerted fashion. I mean, in a sense, there's nothing sort of newfangled about that. That's very much sort of old-fashioned policing, but it's being implemented or directed in much more careful fashion because of this research component. Is that a fair summary of what's going on, for instance, in Philadelphia?
That is fair. I would add to that that in some cases, the source of the innovation is cleverly hidden, so to speak. So yes, there were foot patrols in Philadelphia that proved to be more effective than other approaches to policing. But what's happening behind the scenes is that researchers and crime analysts and police officers themselves are changing the way that they access and use the information that's available to them. So there's been something of a movement in a lot of police agencies around the country to decentralize the crime analysis function. So the crime analysts no longer sit at headquarters, but they sit out at the district stations and they work more directly with police officers and detectives. So that's an innovation. That's an organizational innovation that's taken place in many police departments around the country. That doesn't get the attention that the crime fighting does, so to speak.
Good point. I want to be sure before I have to let you go to give you a chance to talk thoroughly about the story of Chicago, since we're right up the road from Chicago, Illinois, and that's, of course, a major American city that has really been racked with very high violent crime rates and it's good to hear about some of the concerted efforts in Chicago to try to bring some of these issues under better control. What can you tell us about the story of Chicago, Illinois?
I can tell you an awful lot. I can tell you firsthand because I'm a former resident of Chicago. And 20 years ago, I was on the ground floor introducing community policing to Chicago and conducting training sessions in local communities about community policing. And in those 20 years, Chicago has been a chronically, and parts of the city have been chronically extremely violent. And attempt after attempt after attempt by the police department to reduce and quell those pockets of violence have not been effective. In recent years, the Chicago Police Department has introduced the notion of strategic decision support centers. These are information and technology-driven centers that are located in the precinct houses that, again, bring the patrol officer and the detective much closer to the analyst and the information that they need to be effective in their deployment of resources. And in the communities, the first few communities where these support centers were created, communities like Austin and Englewood that, again, have traditionally been very violent communities, we are seeing dramatic reductions in violence and shootings in those communities. And research is suggesting that we can be confident that it was the introduction of these decision support centers that produced at least a fair amount of those reductions.
When will the report done by CNA be available for the public to peruse? And at that point, how can they track it down to take a look at it?
It's available right now. If they go to www.cna.org and scroll about halfway down that page, you'll find a link to the report. You can also go on Twitter to hashtag SPI, the number 10, and you'll find information there.
Very good. James Chip Coldren is Managing Director of Justice Programs in CNA's Safety and Security Division, and he had a very direct hand in the crafting of this report titled The Strategies for Policing Innovation Initiative, Reflecting on 10 Years of Innovation. Thank you, sir, for joining us on the morning show. Thank you for your good work.
Thank you, too, sir. Appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Nan Calvert is paying her monthly visit to the program, and with her will be John Richards, who is with the organization Clean Wisconsin. And we'll be talking about one of Clean Wisconsin's current projects, which is to try to have invoked bans on polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. We'll hear about the success that they have already had in this effort. On Wednesday, Richard Goldstein, the author of a book called Another Little Piece of My Heart, My Life of Rock and Revolution in the 1960s. He was one of the country's leading music critics in the late 1960s and got to meet and encounter some of the most important rock and roll artists of the late 60s. On Thursday, in anticipation of Father's Day, I'm going to be rebroadcasting my memorable conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Michael Chabon, talking in this particular interview about his book, Manhood for Amateurs, The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father, and Son. And on Friday, Jared Yates Sexton, who is the author of a very intriguing book called The Man They Wanted Me to Be, Toxic Masculinity and a Crisis of Our Own Making. Jared Yates Sexton is a contributing political writer at Salon. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the New Republic, and in many other places. He has written a very intriguing book about what he sees as the danger when we have a misunderstanding of masculinity and demand it in unreasonable ways. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org, and the program is also available now as a podcast.